It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll get the story of famous trees here in the state of Wisconsin. First, as we've talked about before on the show, the city of Milwaukee is in the midst of a dramatic spike in gun violence. So far this year, there have been more than twice as many gun homicides in the city as compared with last year. Both city officials and Republican lawmakers have been at odds over what's to blame, with city officials saying the state needs stronger gun laws and some state lawmakers saying Milwaukee isn't enforcing the laws in place. Democratic Representative from Milwaukee, LaTanya Johnson, is teaming up with Republican Joel Clayfish to introduce legislation that would place mandatory minimum sentences on violent felons caught with illegal guns. Representative Johnson joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, could you please start by giving us a preview of what's in the bill?
Basically, the mandatory minimum sentence is designed for violent felons caught in possession of illegal handguns or illegal guns. Basically, what this bill does, it issues a three-year mandatory minimum sentence for violent felons caught in possession of a gun. If that violent felon is using that gun to commit another violent crime, there is a five-year penalty enhancer for Class A to Class G felonies. If the individual is committing a Class H felony or a Class I felony, then the penalty enhancer can range anywhere from 3 years to 1 year, 6 months. Basically, this legislation is designed to get those violent felons who continue to carry continue to carry guns off the street.
Now, a bill similar to this failed last session, along with other gun legislation, and you've modified this to include only violent felons, not all felons. How does that change things?
It basically changes things because there are a number of ways that you could be a convicted felon. That could range anywhere from felony child support. You're not paying child support for your children, so you receive a felony for that offense. What this bill is designed to do is to get those offenders that we feel risk the public safety most off the street. My concern with the legislation from last session was that it was too broad. And, of course, it was the cost. When you talk about incarcerating convicted felons caught in possession of a firearm, unfortunately, just here in the city of Milwaukee alone, that the number could be tremendous, especially when you consider one out of eight adult males over the age of 30 has spent some time in incarceration. So we would have been looking at tremendous, tremendous financial costs to corrections, and that was something that I was hugely concerned about.
And to keep on the topic of incarceration, Wisconsin has the highest rate of black male incarceration in the country. About half of all black men in Milwaukee have been incarcerated by midlife. Are you concerned that this bill could increase the incarceration rate of black men?
I'm not concerned that this bill will contribute to mass incarceration. What this bill will do is get those violent offenders off of our streets. Even though mass incarceration is a concern for our African-American population, so is losing our children to stray bullets. And we have had that happen here in the city of Milwaukee. And for the safety of our entire community, that's why this bill was introduced to only include violent felons, because those individuals put our communities at most risk.
We're talking with Representative LaTanya Johnson about some new gun legislation being considered. And LaTanya, Ms. Johnson, some gun control advocates would argue that the problem of gun violence has more to do with access to guns. And your law gets at criminal history, not at the ability to get a hold of a gun that's already illegal. So why are you using this approach?
Because curbing the violence in our community it's not just limited to violent felons. Wisconsin gun laws are exceptionally weak, which help to aid at individuals who shouldn't be in possession of a gun to get those guns. For example, straw purchases in the state of Wisconsin is only a misdemeanor, and that's unheard of. Some violent misdemeanor offenses in the state of Wisconsin will not prohibit you from getting a concealed carry permit, and that's a huge concern, too. We have habitual offenders who have been arrested multiple times, 3, 4, 5, and the number goes on and on. As long as those individuals have never been convicted of a felony, then they are allowed to have access to a gun legally, and they are also allowed to participate in concealed carry. These are all issues for us because the greatest, the greatest research shows, or the most strongest research shows, that individuals who have a history of past violence are more likely to commit future acts of violence. So this is a huge concern for the community. We need to make sure that the loopholes that surround individuals who shouldn't have guns, that those loopholes are taken care of. And unfortunately, it's contributing to those individuals who are not savory characters. It's allowing them to get legal access to guns.
Now, gun legislation has been a difficult sell in Wisconsin in recent years. Republican Alberta Darling drafted a bill that had some similarities to yours. She couldn't find a co-sponsor. Are you confident that this bill will be more successful?
I am confident that this bill will be more successful. We have had success thus far in making this a bipartisan bill. And that's in large part due to the fact that this bill goes after those individuals that put our community at risk. It's specifically tailored to violent felons. I don't think there's anybody in this entire state that believes that violent felons should have access to guns. Although this legislation is not a deterrent, there will be individuals who will continue to violate the law even once this bill is passed. But one thing it does is that it takes those individuals and it gives them mandatory minimum sentences. And the only thing that will help to make our streets safer is if these individuals are put behind bars where they belong with longer sentences.
And you're holding a meeting for community input this Wednesday. What kind of feedback are you looking for?
I'm looking for feedback from the community, from those who have been affected by gun violence. I know for a fact that 669 individuals were shot last year just here in the city of Milwaukee. So I know that this community is suffering. There are victims out there. Their family members are out there. And I'm looking to hear from those individuals. I'm looking to get their input to see what they think about the legislation that's being introduced and to also have a conversation with the community about what they want to see going forward. What do they feel puts their communities at greater risk? How can we as state legislators be of service to these individuals who have given so much just for the simple fact that they call Milwaukee home? I don't want our community to think that this is not an issue that the state is concerned about, because it is. Loss of life, for any reason, is a hard pill to swallow. But when you talk about innocent children losing their lives, most of them, a lot of them, before they even reach middle school, that's a concern. 76 of the individuals who were shot in 2014 were children under the age of 17. 3 of those children were under the age of 11, and they died. And no one wants to see an innocent child lose their life to a stray bullet. But unfortunately, in the city of Milwaukee, that happened.
Representative Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Representative LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee about her proposed legislation that would create mandatory three-year sentences for violent felons caught with illegal guns. This comes during a dramatic increase in Milwaukee gun violence. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear from a guest who says being around water is a key to making us healthier and happier. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Naturalist John Muir once wrote, "The clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness." Writer Ron Davis went looking for a favorite tree near his home and discovered stories in the bark.
A few weeks ago, a friend posted a photo online of his favorite tree, a magnificent sugar maple in his front yard, probably 5 feet around. In response, I posted one of my own favorites, and soon friends and family were doing likewise. It got me to thinking, does everybody have a favorite tree? I really hope so. On our little chunk of property in the township of Scandinavia, we have thousands of trees. When we first moved here, it was almost solid with 30 or 40-year-old aspen. Most were about 5 or 6 stories tall, only leafing out at the top since we live on the north side of a ridge. Our gloomy woods had little to no understory and scarce wildlife, other than an occasional family of whitetails wandering through, or a bunch of flying squirrels who liked the holes chiseled out by pileated woodpeckers. When a ferocious straight-line wind uprooted and sheared some of the aspens off 20 years ago, we had the land logged. What sprang up next was a cornucopia of species. Ash, red and white oak, birch, basswood, silver maple, a few cherry, and of course, more aspen. An army of wildlife also moved in to feast on the seedlings, buds, raspberries, hazelnuts. Now our little plot is once again solid with trees, making it hard to pick a favorite. It might just be the lonely, towering white pine that stands directly in front of our house. It's got to be almost 100 years old and is one of only a few ancients on the ridge that were left either for seed or because they weren't prime stock. Ours has a double trunk. The broad bottom branches of our pine used to fan out to the ground, making a cool, damp tent. My neighbor Roy told me when he was a boy he'd frequently be sent to fetch their blind cow from beneath its branches, the poor animal lurching around in endless circles. But my favorite could also be the scraggly paper birch in the fence row across the road. Over the years we've lived here, it has resolutely endured blizzards, ice storms, sieges of wild grape and leaf curl, the continual encroachment of the farmer's reach, and the yearly assaults from bucks sharpening up their antlers. We occasionally have a few grouse around, which you can sometimes see silhouetted in the birch's branches, probably hunting for its buds, or maybe, as the old-timers in the neighborhood contend, sitting out their hangovers from eating grapes fermented on the vine. I just can't help but admire that little tree's pluck. On the other hand, maybe it's the white oak I sit in every gun deer season. Sitting up there in November, I can scan 5 miles of snowy countryside, a patchwork quilt of harvested cornfields, woodlots, and swamp. Squirrels like that tree anyway, and will scurry up and down, keeping the trunk between us, sometimes peeking around to wonder at the curious creature shivering away, cloaked in blaze orange. We're tree-rich in Wisconsin. Millions upon billions of trees, each one a brave but silent testament to tenaciousness. Maybe by choosing favorites, our lives, as Shakespeare wrote, give them tongues. Tongues to tell their stories, as well as our own.
Ron Davis teaches English at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. Well, every tree has a story, and joining us now to talk about some of our state's most cherished trees is our Bruce Allison, arborist and author of If Trees Could Talk, Stories About Wisconsin Trees. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
Well, Veronica, great to be with you.
Well, we heard there about favorite trees, and as a guy who knows his Wisconsin trees, do you have a favorite Wisconsin tree?
You know, I've got many favorite trees. And I particularly am attracted to, as you know from the books that I write, those which are historical, which connect us within our generations to those that came before, that tell our historical stories. And it seems appropriate here on Memorial Day, which started in 1868, right after the Civil War, by the Grand Republic Army, to celebrate and decorate the graves of those who have fallen during the Civil War. We still have in Wisconsin, in Delavan, a tree that stands at the intersection of 7th and Washington Street, a tree under which the soldiers, the young boys, 17, 18, 19 years old, gathered to muster to be brought into the Army and to fight to protect the Union. Today, that particular tree, which is probably about 250 years old, remains surrounded by asphalt, and there is a small little chicken pizza place nearby. And I always hope that those young people who were 16, 17, 18, as they walk around listening to their iPods and whatever, remember that 150 years ago, there were people their same age, many of whom never returned as they protected our Union. And of course, they went off to Camp Randall, which was the site in which they were trained to go on to the fight in the South. And there was, up until 1990, a red oak there that had a large plaque beneath it that said, "Dedicated to the memory of Governor Harvey." Lewis Powell Harvey was our second Civil War governor. Of course, our first was Alexander Williams Randall, who was our sixth governor in the state of Wisconsin. And he was noted for raising and organizing volunteers to be able to fight in the war. Harvey, shortly after he became governor, it was April that the Battle of Shiloh took place. He had a great compassion for those Wisconsin soldiers who were lost and injured in that war. So he took a long, long journey down to Tennessee, where the battle had occurred, to look at the soldiers and give them comfort in their makeshift hospitals. Unfortunately, as he was crossing the Tennessee River, he fell off the barge. His body was found 60 miles downstream. And you think that's the end of the story, but it's not. His widow, Cordelia Harvey, carried on his compassion for those soldiers. Carl Sandburg, in his famous biography of Lincoln, writes about her. In fact, he spends more pages on Cordelia Harvey than any other person in that particular book. Cordelia Harvey went to the generals and said, you know, what can we do for these soldiers? She was appointed to sanitary agent to the Union Army, which, of course, was just a way to keep her quiet. You have to remember, at that time, women had no position in the military. Women had very few property rights, and women couldn't even vote. But that didn't hold her back when she recognized how important it was for those soldiers to perhaps come back to the North to be cared for after they were wounded. She went directly to Washington, D.C. She spoke to Abraham Lincoln, argued with him day after day after day, till he finally relented, and the first Civil War hospital was built in Madison, Wisconsin. As a result, Cordelia Harvey was called the Octagonal House, and it made a huge difference in the many people surviving that particular war. And appropriately, after the war, it was turned into an orphanage for those people, those young people that were lost in the war.
Right, she has quite a history in Wisconsin. And talking about trees as memorials, there is a famous tree in Grand County, the Grand County Sycamore, that's a memorial.
Exactly, and that's on Sycamore Crest Farm and Sycamore Road. Early settler by the name of Joseph Crane Orr got that terrible letter from the Department of Defense at that time. Of course, it was called the Department of War, that your son has been injured. He's down in a hospital in Tennessee. Please come and tend to him. Well, he got down there, fortunately, just in time for his son to die in his arms. He brought his son's coffin back to the farm, had a cemetery nearby, and planted a tree, a sycamore tree, as a memorial to his son. And, of course, it's very common for trees to be planted at the time of birth, at the time of death, to commemorate important things. This tree still remains a very important tree. And it seems appropriate when we're talking about John Muir earlier. One of my favorite stories is the John Muir Black Locust, which was right in front of North Hall on campus. Muir came to our campus as a 19-year-old engineering student and was asked to come outside to take a look at a tree which Griswold, who was one of his fellow students who specialized in botany, said, "John Muir, what tree is this?" And Muir said, "Well, I'm an engineering student. I don't really know." And Griswold said, "Well, take a look at the flower. What does it look like? You're a farmer." And Muir said, "Well, it looks like a pea flower." "And but how could that be? A pea is a small, straggly plant. This is a big, tall tree." Well, it just so happened that Griswold knew he had him then, because he talked about taxonomy, that connection between all living things, that somehow this big black locust tree is a legume just like a small, straggly pea. John Muir remembered that in his My Boyhood and Youth and went on to become a naturalist shortly thereafter. And oddly enough, Muir Knoll was dedicated in 1918 after Muir's death. His granddaughter came as part of that dedication, and she noted that her grandfather would always plant a black locust tree whenever he changed houses.
Wow, beautiful stories. Thank you so much for sharing them on this Memorial Day, Bruce.
Happy to be here.
We've been talking to R. Bruce Allison, arborist and author of If Trees Could Talk, Stories About Wisconsin Trees. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin Democratic congresswoman who says the kinds of restrictions Republicans are looking to put on people receiving public benefits is what she calls forced paternalism. But first, on this Memorial Day, many of us might be enjoying a dip in the pool, maybe sitting by the lake. Our next guest says proximity to water, oceans, lakes, and rivers has a scientifically proven record for improving creativity, health, and our sense of compassion. Wallace J. Nichols joins us. He's a research associate at the California Academy of Science and the author of Blue Mind, the surprising science that shows how being near, in, on, or underwater can make you happier, healthier, more connected, and better at what you do. Wallace, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've coined this term, blue mind. What does it mean?
Well, it's a shorthand for the feeling you have when you step up to the edge of the water, where you feel relaxed, where you feel clear, where maybe you feel more connected to the person that you're with. And it's just an overall good, happy feeling that many of us have when we go on vacation or at the end of a long day when we take a break by a lake or a river, or in the case of us out here in California, by the ocean. So we just call that overall state of mind, blue mind.
That sounds like something sort of intangible, just sort of a general feel-good feeling that people get when they're near water because it's relaxing. But you say there's actual science behind the idea of blue mind. What do we know about why water is good for us?
Yeah, we used to think it was intangible, and then, you know, we entered the modern age of neuroscience, or the golden years of neuroscience, and now we're able to look inside the brain and check out our brain chemistry, look at our physiology, and if we want to spend a little more money, put people in the lab and have a look at their brain patterns. And what we find is that when you're standing in front of blue space, when you're standing in front of water, your heart rate slows, your breathing rate slows, you relax a bit more, your brain produces a set of feel-good chemicals, and that's in contrast to what we call red mind, which is the agitated state that we're often in throughout the day with deadlines and emails and perhaps traffic or screaming kids, and stepping out of that red mind into blue mind and just relaxing for a bit changes our chemistry, changes our bodies, changes our brains. And we can do certain things a little bit better, such as creativity, insight, innovation, perhaps writing poetry or coming up with a brand new idea. A lot of people throughout the ages have found that sitting in the bathtub, floating down a river, or maybe bathing in the ocean has opened them up to new ways of thinking. And now we're understanding exactly how that works.
So it's not just oceans. Obviously, you know, the ocean is a majestic example of what water can be, but you're saying the benefits are there for lakes, for rivers, for streams.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to high school in Illinois next to Lake Michigan, and I know that in Wisconsin, you know, with the 15,000 lakes and 84,000 miles of river, a lot of people are spending time next to those kinds of bodies of water and getting their blue minds on. And the key thing, the key message is, if the lakes and the rivers and the oceans and the bays are not healthy, we won't get our blue mind on. We'll go there and it'll make us sad. It'll make us maybe a little edgy because we remember those places being places we could swim or recreate. And when that is taken away from us, not only do we lose the ecological benefits of healthy waterways, but we also lose the cognitive and emotional and social benefits of those waters. And that's really the underlying message, I think, of the book.
So this is really about also conservation, about why humans should care about water beyond just the fact that we don't want pollution. You're saying it physiologically affects our well-being.
Yeah, if you imagine your town with its lakes and rivers and ponds and perhaps coastlines, and imagine if you couldn't go there. Imagine if you couldn't access that water in a safe way. Imagine it was cut off for you from you and your family, or when you got there, it was in bad shape. You would lose more than just money. You'd lose more than just the ecological costs, which are both true. You lose all these other, often referred to as softer benefits. But in fact, they're what make life worth living. You know, we celebrate our weddings and funerals. We propose to each other. We have our best memories, our funnest moments in summertime, splashing around in water in many cases. And imagine that taken away. And I think that's even makes our argument for healthy waterways even more powerful. And when we could put science behind these feelings, these emotions, these intangibles, it makes them more tangible and gives us a more powerful argument in policy settings for protecting our lakes and our rivers and our oceans.
Well, let's dig into some of that science. When we look at it from that perspective, what exactly happens inside our brains and our bodies, let's say, when we go for a dip in Lake Superior?
Well, you know, we know that cortisol is a stress hormone. We know that when we're under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress, our bodies produce cortisol, and that's really important. I mean, red mind is a very important reaction to the world around us. But if we have sustained high levels of cortisol, sustained stress, that becomes toxic, and scientists and doctors refer to that as toxic stress. It interferes with our health. And 60% of modern diseases and illnesses are connected to stress. So as we become more and more stressed out and we're unable to manage it, we get sick or we don't heal. Now contrast that with the blue mind state. When you take a break at the end of a day or in the middle of a day or during the summer, during vacation, and you step out of the daily grind and you're able to relax and feel that water washing over you, go for a swim in the lake, then you're reducing your stress level. And that has massive implications for your health. Now, we can't do it every day. We can't be on vacation all the time. But we can find proxies for that feeling. So that may be taking a bath or having a photograph of that favorite water place on your wall or as a screensaver or going back and looking at videos from your vacation and sinking into that feeling once in a while and getting away from it all, because we can't be out there all the time. Unless, of course, you're a marine biologist, you can spend a little more time on the ocean. So basically, cortisol management or stress management is a big part of it. But it goes beyond that. And when we're at the water, it holds our attention. And scientists and psychologists call that soft fascination. So water keeps our interest. You know, you talk to people and they'll sit by the water for their entire vacation, and you ask, what did you do? And they'll say, oh, I just sat and looked at the water. I really love sitting and looking at the water, and it doesn't get boring. It's always changing, and it's always interesting. And throughout the day, it holds our attention, whether it's a river or a lake or the ocean. And it holds us in that relaxed state, where our heart rate is lower, where our breathing rate is lower, where our blood pressure is lower. And that's really good. It holds you in that relaxed state. And when you're in that state, your brain shifts over to what scientists call the default mode network. And that's a brain network that is much more aligned with self-referential thinking, insight, innovation, and creativity, versus the more active mode network that we're experiencing during the day, where we're solving the problems that are right in front of us, where we're attending to the noise and the conversations and the emails, which is a much more active mode. Now we're in this what's called the default mode, and we're relaxing, and we're having a, some people describe it as a feeling of oneness. And it turns out when you have that kind of feeling, following that, you're much more likely to engage in empathetic or compassionate activities. You're much more likely to see yourself as part of the whole versus just a single individual. And so that's another outcome of this blue mind experience.
You make it sound meditative. And didn't I read that you said water meditates you? So instead of you trying to come at it from that approach, water does it for you.
Yeah, that's right. It's a mildly meditative state. And it turns out physiologically, it's similar to what happens when people meditate. Although you don't need to know how to meditate. All you need to know is where the water is and need to get out and experience it. So the water does meditate us.
We're talking with Wallace J. Nichols, the author of Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. And we'd like to hear from you on this. As you enjoy the beginning of summer, maybe heading out to the lake or going further out to the ocean, maybe to a nearby river, do you notice what our guest is talking about? Is your brain happier when you're near water? And why do you think that is? Post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now we'll look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Wallace J. Nichols, the author of Blue Mind, The Surprising Science That Shows How Being Near, In, On, or Underwater Can Make You Happier, Healthier, More Connected, and Better at What You Do. And we'd like to hear from you on this as you enjoy this Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial start of summer, maybe heading out to the lakes or checking out a local river. Do you notice what our guest is talking about? Is your brain happier when you're near water? And why do you think that is? You can share your thoughts and pictures over on the Central Time Facebook page. We're going to the phones now, and we'll start with Sherry in Milwaukee. Sherry, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was listening to the conversation with great interest. I recently learned to swim, or swim better, I should say, this last summer, and I'm going to do a sprint triathlon in August.
Huh.
So I've been practicing swimming, and I always try to explain to people that I feel like the water stays with me all day. You know, when the days that I swim, I feel it's indescribable, but I feel the water with me all day. I feel at ease. I feel more comfortable, and it's a feeling that stays with me for the entire day. And also, the days that I swim, if I run the next day, my asthma is better. It's not as bad. So I find that interesting, too. So I don't know how the water helps that. But I hate getting wet, but I love once I'm in the water.
Oh, Sherry, thank you so much for sharing that. You're making me want to go swimming. I bet that sounds familiar to you, Jay.
Very familiar. You know, you hear the same thing, you know, friends that surf out here in cold water, and sometimes they say, you know what, I'm not even enjoying surfing in this cold water, but when I get out of the water, I feel so good all day that it's worth it. So it's kind of a therapy, and sometimes you just, you know, you swallow that pill, you get in the water, the blue mind pill, and then you have the benefits that last some, you know, all day, sometimes all week, and you know surfers call it the surfer stoke, and I imagine there's a similar term for swimmers in Wisconsin to that. Yeah, for sure.
Jay, isn't there a program that uses water therapy with veterans?
Yes, we work very closely with several organizations, and one of them is called Heroes on the Water, and they use kayak therapy and kayak fishing as a way to get veterans sort of outside in motion and on the water. And, you know, if you've ever been kayak fishing, you know that you do spend a lot of time sitting on the water, neither kayaking nor fishing, but waiting. And that time is very relaxing. And for folks with post-traumatic stress, that's really important to be able to relax. There's another group called Operation Surf, and they use surfing and teaching veterans to surf as a way of doing the same thing. And some of the men and women who participate in these programs report that they sleep for the first time that night after these activities, that they're much more relaxed, that they can consider at least dialing back some of the medications that they're on and reducing their dosages and reducing the side effects that some of those prescription drugs can cause. And so I'm always very careful to point out this is certainly not a silver bullet solution to the all of the modern ills and the things that keep us awake at night. But over and over, we hear stories from really all corners of society that being out on or in the water, even near the water, does help them live a better life. So something to consider.
Thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Bob in Green Bay. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I just wanted to call in, and I listening to the program, I absolutely, unequivocally agree with the Blue Mind theory. I just wanted to say quick that I worked about 5-6 years corporate America. I absolutely felt the red mind, and I kind of snapped. I went out and bought a sailboat and moved on to a boat. Now I live on the water in Florida, and it is the best move I've ever made in my life.
Huh. That sounds pretty great. So what is it about being on the boat, Bob, that you feel?
Everything that is mentioned before, calmness, heartbeat slows down. As soon as I step onto the boat and everything kind of flows with the water, the ebb and flow of it, blood pressure drops instantly. So now I'm to the point where I don't even like getting on land. I just prefer staying on my boat the whole time. It's wonderful.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that, Bob. And Jay, not everyone can live on a boat. In Wisconsin, we run into some ice issues, but what are some ways we can get near to the water and enjoy some of what Bob's got?
Well, certainly seasonally, that's an activity that everyone can work to participate in. And I think one of the keys is to always try to take someone with you, maybe someone who doesn't have a boat or has never really thought of checking out the Great Lakes and rivers. It also reminded me, I was hoping somebody from Green Bay would call in because my mom grew up in Green Bay, and she's had a lifelong fear of water. And it was just kind of strange considering the work that I do. And recently at her 50th anniversary, we were all together in Hawaii with my mom and dad, and my daughters and I got her into the ocean for the first time in 50 years.
What happened?
Really. And she was very nervous. But my daughters and I held her up, and she floated on her back. And I have to say, I've never seen her so relaxed in my entire life. She just floated on her back in this nice, warm Hawaiian ocean, and it was a great moment. And she wants to get back. She wants to get back in the ocean. She's always loved sitting and looking at the water, but never wanted to get into it, due to some early life experiences in pools and lakes, and that didn't go so well, kids jumping on her and stuff. And she has had a lifelong fear of water, but now she's back, and a little bit later in life, but we'll see her in swimming a little bit more than we have for the past 50 years.
So. Oh, that's a fantastic story. And let's go next to Joe. Joe is joining us in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm a scuba diver, and I completely agree with this whole idea. It's wonderful to be underwater and just completely buoyant or neutral. But my question would be, you mentioned blue in your research, and does the sky have the same effect? Or is it the fact that we're terrestrial beings and water's a liquid in an unfamiliar environment that creates this effect?
Really good questions, Joe. I'm glad you brought up the color blue. Jay, what does that have to do with it in the
sky?
Yeah,
that's a great question. And I think one of the observations is not all water looks blue. Some of the great places to swim are brownish or greenish, or sometimes swimming at night, it's anything but blue. And so it is the color. There's lots of research on color psychology that suggests that blue light does have an effect on our brains. That's different from other colors and other qualities of light. So looking at the sky, particularly if it's a clear blue sky, is appealing. But one of the things you lose when you're looking at a solid color, a blue wall or a blue sky or a blue screen, is the dynamic interaction. So the water is changing. So it's not just the color, although it is the color. It's also the sound. It's not just the sound and the color. It's also the feel. And it's that dynamic, the light bouncing off of the surface of the water, creating this changing kind of mosaic of color and light. So it's all of these things put together, but to understand them, in the book, we kind of unpack it, and we take on each of the senses, we take on each of these elements, and then try to wrap it all back together into this concept we call blue mind. So you can have these kinds of feelings like taking a hike in the forest or climbing a mountain and looking at the vista. And we find that people have a lot of happiness and get a lot of joy, have a lot of stress reduction hiking in the forest. And it's even more if the forest has a creek or a river or a lake or the destination of that hike is water. So yes to green space, yes to open sky, yes to stars and moon, and add water to that situation. Looking at the stars, looking at the sunset, looking at the sky by the water, even better. So, you know, we kind of joke a bit and say just add water to any situation and it'll make it more fun. So if you have a balloon, it's fun, but if you have a water balloon, it's really fun. And it just changes the party.
Oh, fantastic. We're going to leave it there. Jay, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm really, really happy to speak with you, and great calls from your listeners.
That was Wallace J. Nichols, author of Blue Mind, the surprising science that shows how being near, in, on, or underwater can make you happier, healthier, more connected, and better at what you do. Our producer, Chris Molina, joins me in the studio now. He just got back from the shores of Lake Superior and experienced his own concept of Blue Mind firsthand. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Veronica.
So you were up at Lake Superior, and it sounds like you hadn't been there for a long time. It was almost like seeing it for the first time.
It's true. The last time I was up on the shores of Lake Superior, I was a kid. We went on a family vacation to the Ashland Bayfield area, and I was up there, had the chance to go up there last week for the Bayfield and Bloom broadcast with Larry Mueller. And, you know, there's something sort of magical almost about Lake Superior is kind of what I felt. You know, you're kind of driving up there and you're on a highway and you're surrounded by all this beautiful land and it's great. And then you kind of get up towards Ashland and then you see the lake all of a sudden just kind of spread out in front of you. And it just kind of hits you all of a sudden. And it's just kind of your mood just shifts totally immediately. And it's sort of remarkable. So, and just the entire time I was up there, you know, just knowing I was near the lake was something kind of special and definitely, you know, kind of put me at ease. And I would say the saddest part was, you know, coming back, you know, you're kind of driving down Highway 2 and you have the lake on your left and you're going and you know that it's this fleeting feeling and you finally make that turn off of Highway 2 and you kind of look in the lake in the rear view mirror as long as you possibly can to kind of savor every last drop.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and I know the bend in the highway where you have to say goodbye to the lake. It hurts.
It hurts. It definitely hurts. And I know this is something that you've experienced too. We've talked a little bit before in the past about how you like spending time on Madeline Island.
Right. I mean, Madeline Island is my Blue Mind place for sure, and the water so clear you can see right down to the beautiful rocks beneath. So I totally get what Wallace Nichols is talking about.
Road trip after the show, let's go. Six
Definitely.
Hours later, we'll be there.
Are we going to be back in time for tomorrow's show?
Yeah, pass.
We'll be fine.